When I think about the crowds clamoring after Jesus pressing into one another and what that must have been like, one memory comes to mind for me, and that is camping out for Duke basketball tickets. If you're not aware of this bizarre and hallowed tradition within the world of college athletics, let me fill you in. So, Duke, one of the most celebrated teams in the history of college basketball, plays in one of its smallest arenas called Cameron Indoor Stadium, which is a recipe for one of the most thrilling fan experiences in all sports. It's also a recipe for what our economist friends call scarcity. Scarcity, we know, creates demand, in this case, such that people are, in the case of ordinary citizens, willing to pay exorbitant amounts of money to obtain these tickets. Or in the case of Duke students like myself, they're willing to endure sadistic sociological experiments in hopes of obtaining such tickets. The sadistic sociological experiment was called the Duke Basketball Campout. Here's how it worked. Campout was held from early Friday to a Sunday morning in a field on campus, a small field, of which there was exorbitant demand for square footage of grass. There was a tent set up on every square inch you could imagine. I kid you not, the first year at campout, I had to sleep on a 45-degree incline that was half grass and half sidewalk. Picture a slum, basically. A slum of very rich people. At the center of this tent city was a single giant white music festival style tent. You know what I'm talking about. And every so often, about 30 times or so over the course of the weekend, at purposely random increments, something like an air raid siren would go off from the tent. And that meant that everybody at the campout had 5 minutes to check in with their ID badge at the central tent. So you can imagine every siren, chaos would ignite. Snacks would fly through the air. Bodies would collide against other bodies as they were sprinting towards the tent. You know, cornhole scores were instantly vaporized into the air and forgotten. The goal is to make it to the end of the weekend without missing any check-ins. I think you were maybe allowed to miss one. You might think to yourself, that doesn't sound too difficult to accomplish. Just miss a little sleep, perhaps. But ask yourself this question. How are a field full of young idiots going to fill the rest of those hours? And how might those decisions make it easier or perhaps more difficult to, say, wake up and walk the 100 yards to the central check-in tent? Here's the real kicker, though. If you made it to the end of the weekend successfully, having only missed one or less check-in, then your name gets thrown into a lottery in which you have about a 30% chance of winning basketball tickets. Earning entrance to Cameron Indoor Stadium on game day may not be an experience of miraculous healing, but it's probably as close as I have come in this life. My point is, in our gospel reading for today, Jesus is a Duke basketball ticket. Everybody wants him. If we zoom out a tiny bit for context, what's happening in this portion of Mark's gospel is almost hilarious if you trace the geography of it. So what's happening is that Jesus and his disciples are being pressed in by these crowds up against the Sea of Galilee, and they're pressed in and pressed in, such that eventually their only escape is to get in a boat and row across to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Only as they do, they just watch the crowds run around the shore of the Sea of Galilee to the other side. And in last week's reading, they do it again. They press in, they crowd the disciples against the shore, so eventually they get back in the boat and they row across the other side and they watch the crowds race around the shore. You can see this like playing out in an old black and white kind of film, right? Kind of, it's hilarious. Jesus has charisma, he has wisdom, he has miracles, but most desirable of all, Jesus has the power to heal. And in this episode, we zoom in on just two members of the clamoring throng. And they're about as opposite as they could be. One is Jairus, a leader of the local synagogue. He is a prominent member of the community. That's what we're told. We're not often told the names of these one-off side characters in the Gospels. It's a way of saying he's important. Jairus is the kind of person that can show up late and will be ushered to the front nonetheless. He's like one of those people when you go to a UT football game and you see the people that get to park right there, you're like, who is this person? That's Jairus. I imagine the crowds parting when they see Jairus approaching, for not only is he a respected local leader, but probably the fact that his daughter is ill, and in fact, perhaps even on death's door, is probably known to the whole community. Come, lay your hands on her, says Jairus, so that she may be made well and live. And Jesus, who seems to often have a soft spot for parents with sick children, says, of course. And they head off in the direction of Jairus' house. It looks like we're going to read just another simple and straightforward story about healing. But as we know, the crowds do not make it easy for Jesus and the disciples to move very quickly, to move very efficiently. And plus, others are still trying to get Jesus' attention. Others want Duke basketball tickets too. And so we're told at this point about a woman who has been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. Someone who's tried everything, who's lost everything, whose insurance has not covered the treatment, and who is worse off, not better, despite the treatment she received. She is desperate, and she is aggressive. So aggressive that she presses towards Jesus in the crowds and reaches out and grabs hold of his cloak in hopes that even that would be enough for Jesus' power to zap out of him and into her. The woman essentially cuts in line, which is a bold move in its own right, but made all the more so if you understand the purity laws that are underneath this story. You see, the woman's condition, the nature of her condition, has essentially rendered her permanently and irreversibly ritually unclean. Which not only meant that she would not be allowed to participate in any public religious life, but essentially meant that she had to live in complete isolation from all others, because the laws also say that anyone she comes in contact with, anyone she touches, also themselves become ritually unclean. She is desperate enough to break all the rules. And the astonishing thing is that Jesus lets her. Jesus approves of her, heals her, and blesses her. And we see this beautiful reversal of the Levitical purity laws. By her reaching out to touch Jesus, the old laws would say that Jesus then becomes unclean. But what happens is the transfer goes in the reverse direction. You can't make Jesus dirty. In fact, you are made clean by touching him. Which brings us to the first lesson, I think, from this story. And it sounds a little bit sacrilegious. It sounds sacrilegious to say that Jesus has favorites. But reading through any of the Gospels, nothing could be more obvious than that Jesus totally has favorites. It's those who are on the margins of society. Jesus spends most of his time with the marginalized. Jesus recruits his disciples from among the marginalized. He not only allows this woman to interrupt his journey towards the home of this important man, he welcomes it. He stops everything. He gives her all the time she wants. Enough time, we're told, that she shares with him the whole truth about her life. He all of a sudden makes her his number one priority. Jesus could not in good conscience go and heal the daughter of this wealthy man while this marginalized woman continued to suffer right in his face. Jesus absolutely has favorites. The last shall always be first with Jesus. That's the first lesson. And we know how the story keeps going. Next, it turns out, we're told that while Jesus was paying attention to the woman who had suffered from 12 years of hemorrhages, the daughter of Jairus has died. The implication is clear. It's because Jesus attended to this interruption that Jairus' daughter ran out of time. Everyone in the story but Jesus is looking at this situation through the economist's lens of scarcity. There's only so many basketball tickets. There's only so much time. There's only so much healing. Jesus only has so much power that can zap out of him. And the clock in this instance has simply run out. And what only Jesus knows is that he operates within an entirely different economy altogether. Not one of scarcity, but one of abundance upon abundance. An economy in which there's always enough healing to go around. Where what's good for one person is not something that another person can't now have. But what's good for one person is good for that person's neighbor too. Jesus is a rising tide that raises all boats. With the God of the universe, you never run out of time and you never run out of life. So between these two healings, we see two lessons at once. Lessons that appear almost contradictory on their surface, but which are paradoxically true with Jesus. It's that Jesus has favorites, and Jesus loves everyone the same. Jesus gives priority to the marginalized, but Jesus makes time for everyone. If we were asked to choose between Jairus and the unnamed woman, the model commended to us is unambiguous. The unnamed woman is the exemplar of faith we're meant to follow. What would it be like to have a faith so strong that you could defy social convention, to boldly associate yourself with Jesus out in public, especially if doing so exposed your very worst secret, your most deeply held burdens to the whole world? May we all aspire to have such faith. But still, I can't help but wonder if Jairus isn't his own kind of role model for some of the rest of us. What I mean is, I can't help but notice that the text does not say what it seems obvious it should say after Jairus' helpers come up and say, "Your daughter has died. Why bother the teacher any longer?" What the text should say is that Jairus went into a rage. And Jairus started screaming, "That's not fair. I was in line first. My daughter would still be alive if Jesus hadn't stopped to care for this woman who clearly nobody else cares about. This whole town is worried about me and my daughter. This is not fair." Who in their right mind wouldn't do that? Is it possible that Jairus stood aside willingly? Even agreeing maybe with Jesus that he should, of course, first stop and attend to this woman? Believing even, perhaps, that even if his daughter did die while he was waiting, that Jesus was powerful enough to raise her back to life? Is it possible that Jairus sees how his salvation would be incomplete if others, especially those more marginalized than he, were still suffering? Sometimes the best thing that those in powerful positions can do is simply give others their place in line. At the end of the day, I'm not sure we have to choose anyways. What both Jairus and the unnamed woman share in common is something that I'm not sure many of us do in the first place, which is that they're both standing in front of Jesus and asking for healing. That's an accomplishment in its own right. Who among us is bold enough to stand up in public and admit something as simple as, "I do not have it all together. I am in pain. My life is not going how I planned it. I worry all the time about everything. I'm lonely. This right here is the main reason that, generally speaking, more people experience personal transformation in 12-step meetings like AA than they do in most churches. Because AA meetings always start the same way. You stand up and you say, "My name is Zach and I'm an alcoholic. My name is Zach and I do not have it all together. My name is Zach and I need healing." Once you've started there, you're ready to go chasing after Jesus, to chase him from shore to shore. You're ready to press through the crowds and reach. And notice, Jesus, in both cases, does not leave the person who needs healing alone with just their healing. The woman got what she came for just by touching him. She could have run away, but Jesus stopped the whole parade and turned around and said, "Who was that? I know you're already healed, but that's not enough. I want to know you. I want to know the whole truth about your life. I want to be in relationship with you." And then we get that lovely little detail at the end of the story of Jairus' daughter. Jesus instructs the household to give her something to eat. What a bizarre detail. But it's just a way of saying, this girl's got to keep going on now. She needs more than just healing. She needs nourishment. She needs sustenance. She wants to be in relationship with the God of the universe. I wonder what you need healing from this morning. You don't have to rush. Remember, Jesus will get to each of you eventually. Jesus is not going to run out of time for you. But I do think it's worth asking yourself this question. If you already know you do need healing, why would you want to wait? Amen.